Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight as Bettina Arndt makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I just turn off my phone and start again, okay? Because Channel 648's here, we've all got to be on our best behaviour on Foxtel and Oster. Okay, so I'll start again. Thanks for coming along tonight as Bettina Arndt makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's been here on a number of occasions, but most recently with her previous book, which was called The Sex Diaries, and before that with a book on collected work on or edited work of her father's work, which I suppose also had something to do with sex because Bettina spoke about it, and now tonight on what men want in bed. So I'll introduce Bettina Arndt briefly. She's very well known. She trained as a clinical Bettina Arndt trained as a clinical psychologist before becoming a sex therapist and a social commentator. As editor of the influential Forum magazine, she spent 10 years talking about sex on television and radio. She then moved on to writing about broader social issues, working as a columnist and feature writer for leading newspapers and magazines. And she's the best-selling author of Private Lives, All About Us, Taking Sides in the Sex Diaries, and of course, her book about Heinz Arndt, who was a good friend of the Sydney Institute. So it's great to have Bettina Arndt back on the topic of man's best friend. Bettina Arndt, very well.
Thank you, Jared. I mean, it's quite funny, we've just had this little tussle about whether it was too soon to have sex once again. I mean, if we took that attitude about politics, we can't do politics, we had it last week, where would we be? I mean, sex is this wonderful, broad topic. I could actually come here every week and talk about sex. We still wouldn't get to the end of the rich possibilities available for discussion. What I'm talking today about is the whole issue of man's best friend. I'm actually talking about penises mainly, and the whole question of how men are coping with this wonderful new era that's available for older men in particular. I noticed this nice little cartoon the other day that had an elderly gentleman sitting on a cliff face, totally naked. Next to him is his little grandchild, saying to him, "Grandpa, why are you sitting there naked like that?" And he said, "It was your grandma's idea. Yesterday I sat here without a shirt on and I got a stiff neck." it was interesting how many jokes there are about elderly women wanting lots of sex. And I think that's much more wish fulfillment than everything else. And than anything else, it's very much about what men would like to think women want. And the truth is rather different. Many women are delighted with the thought that men might be ready to hang up their spurs and are rather horrified when he shows signs of wanting to leap back in the saddle. But that's what I'm essentially focusing on today. Last year, when I was here talking about the sex diaries, I was talking about my research on this gap between men and women in their interest in sex and the fact that so many women experience low desire when they settle into their relationships. I noticed Steve Martin the other day commenting, "You know that look women get in their eyes when they want sex? Me neither." But I was particularly interested when I was doing my research for the first book, I was very interested in looking at the older couples. I hadn't really anticipated that, but I did very deliberately get a huge range of, I had 20-year-old students and I had 80-year-olds and I had everything in between. But the older couples were really interesting. And I thought it would be really intriguing to follow them up and look at how couples are dealing with this whole new age of Viagra, this age where men have an opportunity for a new lease of sexual life that certainly wasn't there a few generations ago. We have one man in two over 50 experiencing problems with erectile dysfunction, and it goes up from then on. 20,000 men a year are diagnosed with prostate cancer, and most of them are going to experience problems with erections, at least for a time. So in my first project, I was just really interested to see how couples were dealing with all of this. And there was this, so there were two couples in particular that sort of stood out for me. One of them was, and they're both actually going through the whole business of prostate cancer and dealing with the consequences of that. And one of them was a man who wrote to me, and he was so upset. He wrote to me and said he had just had this great sex life. He'd been married for 40-something years, really loving couple. Sex was really important to both of them. She made him have lots of sex in the period leading up to the surgery, just in case it didn't work afterwards. And unfortunately, it didn't work. I mean, in fact, he wrote to me a few months later saying that he tried all the erection treatments. Nothing was working. He was terribly upset about this. He said, "I feel like half a man." And I wrote back to him and said, "Look, obviously I don't know what that feels like, but I can imagine it's an enormous loss for you. Because the problem is that, you know, it is very much part of the way a man defines himself. This whole issue of being able to have an erect penis." We had this long exchange, and after a few months he wrote back to me and he said, "You don't know what that meant to me, to have someone acknowledge how important this is, to have someone acknowledge that loss." Anyway, we had this long correspondence. He was keeping diaries for me, writing about what was happening, the struggles they were having to try to make love in a way that worked for both of them. And finally I got this really delighted email. He was so excited. They'd worked out a way of doing it, you know. She lay on top of him, she rubbed herself against him in a certain way, and it worked. She climaxed, and they were happy about that. But she said she really missed having something inside. She liked having this erect penis inside her. And so he trotted off to a sex shop, and he bought some sort of dildo. He was a bit of an engineer. He made this thing out of rubber, I think, to hold it all in place. And they call it Mr. Pinocchio. And so my chapter is called Three Cheers for Mr. Pinocchio. But really interesting. So here we have a couple for whom intercourse is very important, for her as well as for him. She loved the erect penis. So that's one particular approach. Now, there was another couple, very interesting. They were seeing their urologist prior to his prostate cancer surgery. And the urologist turned to her and said, "How do you feel about being poked?" I thought it was quite an interesting way of putting it, really. I actually met that urologist the other day, and he explained that he's an old friend of the family's, which is why he used this, I suppose, rather casual language. But it was a really good question, because he was asking her, how did she feel if her husband couldn't get erections anymore? Did it matter to her? And she wrote to me and she said, "I sat there and I thought, whoopee." She said, "I love the idea of not having that third person in our bed with its hard demands." Now, really interesting. So here's a woman who's never really enjoyed intercourse. I mean, she loves being made love to. She loves him touching her. She likes oral sex. She likes what they call outer course. And so when the doctor put this question to them and invited them really to talk about this, they went home and they had this long discussion about this whole issue. And she said to him that there was always been this tension around intercourse because he thought she should climax that way and it never worked for her. And so they ended up having this discussion where he decided in the end not to try using any of the erection treatments and to just see how they went. And they both wrote to me, that was now nearly 10 years ago, and they said they've never been happier. Because for the first time in her life, she's getting the sort of sex she really wants. He's touching her, you know, caressing her. And she's initiating sex for the first time. And he said, I'm fine. You know, obviously I miss erections to some extent, but I'm so happy that she's really enjoying it and taking a whole different approach to our lovemaking. Now, isn't that fascinating? You've got these two couples dealing with essentially the same situation, but with such different experiences. And it's not, of course, just about the male experiences, it's about the woman's experience as well, and how rare it is that doctors who are dealing with these couples actually talk to the woman as well as the man about what's going on for them. Now, that just really fascinated me, and I thought, I have to follow this up. And so I went ahead. I wanted to do the whole book and the whole project on erections, and my publisher wouldn't let me, and I thought, well, mainly because they said it's just too embarrassing for me to go and have to ask for the book on the penis, you know. So, but I have ended up with 5 chapters on erections. I had 150 men kept diaries for me all last year. Some of them just wrote, you know, answered very detailed questionnaires, wrote histories, some of their partners wrote as well. But the focus was very much on men and on the whole business of being a male and men's sexual needs. What's it like to live with 20 times the testosterone that most women have? How do they cope with this powerful drive? What is the impact on their relationships of dealing with that? Why do men take such risks for sex? I mean, we see this passing parade of famous men caught with their pants down, you know, Tiger Woods, politicians, sportsmen, you name it. Men will do all, you know, take enormous risks for sex and get into all sorts of trouble as a result of it. So I was very interested to talk to men about that and see what they said about that. I looked at why men use pornography, a fascinating area, because this is a real battleground now between men and women. I mean, of course, there's always been porn, there's always been some visual material to satisfy what is a very visual interest men have in sexuality. They like looking at things. One man, I mean, men talked about, for instance, you know, poring over their dad's Playboy. Playboy was like gold to a schoolboy, one man said. That whole business of, one man also talking about, you know, how he'd leap on the newspaper when it was delivered in the hope that there would be a Kmart underwear catalogue. Men have always been interested in looking, and now they're looking in their homes because, of course, the internet is bringing pornography into the home and causing all sorts of strife because women have such trouble dealing with the fact that men are interested in this very explicit visual material. And such a different thing from what many women enjoy, I mean, perhaps the erotica that some women enjoy. Isabel Allende once said that erotica is like using a feather, pornography the whole chicken. And I was very interested in knowing why men need the whole chicken and to have them write about that and to have the couples talk about how they deal with tension over this issue was really fascinating. So there were a whole range of issues I was looking at. But as I said, the heart of it is the whole business of man's best friend. Is men's relationship with their penis and the triangle, the relationship between the man, the penis and the partner was what really interested me. Because, of course, it's very much an issue of how do men adapt to the changes in their body and how do their partners feel about this as well. So I had this fantastic material from men. Talking about the whole business, for instance, of losing their erections and what that actually feels like. This is not living, this is just existing, said one man. I don't feel like a man anymore with a piece of marshmallow between my legs. I've lost my best friend, even if he was a dickhead. I mean, some of this is so tragic that it was always wonderful when the men managed to retain their sense of humour in the midst of what can be quite an ordeal for them. Really interesting because there is this vast array of different treatments now out there and no one has any good information about how it's working out for men. How do they feel about it? What are the side effects? What are the problems with these different treatments? And a fascinating thing, the Viagras, the tablets, there's 3 tablets, Viagra, Cialis and Levitra. Half the men who start using them give up on them. Now, what's going on here? I mean, how much of that is to do with side effects? How much is it to do with the cost of the treatment? How much is it to do with the way their partners react? So I was very keen to get the men to really talk in detail about some of these issues. Wonderful stuff from men, talking about what it's like not to have had an erection for years and then to use a treatment that gives you one. The first time was amazing, said one man. It felt like I was 20 again. This is the best thing since sliced bread, but much dearer, he said. Here's a man using one of the injection treatments. He says, Willie was up ready to play for 45 minutes. Oh, what a feeling, Toyota. So, you know, this incredible celebration from many of the men at the fact that they could do it again, they could get an erection again. Even men who didn't even have partners, just to have that feeling again was what they would talk about. The lengths men would go to keep their equipment working. I had this fascinating man who I call my toilet roll Houdini, who boasted of the fact that he's always worked on his pelvic muscles. I mean, I'm sure many of you men don't even know you have pelvic muscles, but just as women get taught all about these when they go through childbirth, but men in fact can do muscles to strengthen, exercises to strengthen the muscles in the pelvic area. And this guy had got it down to a fine art. He was so proud of his strong muscles. And he said when he was young, he used to be able to stuff his penis into the core of a toilet roll, and with one flick of his muscles, he would burst out. End to end. Gosh, I thought it was hilarious. And then he complained bitterly that they started trying to cheat us by putting less toilet paper on the toilet roll, and they made the rolls thicker, and he couldn't do it anymore. I think that might actually reflect the strength of his muscles. Anyway, so what we had was, what I have is this material of men talking about how these different treatments are working out for them. And it's really fascinating, of course, because once again, you have to put that man in with this partner and see what happens then. And we have, of course, many women who aren't interested in sex, who were hoping that he was, you know, the penis would be put out to pasture. And all of a sudden, he's coming back waving his new Viagra script, and she's not at all happy about that. We have treatments that take an hour or so to kick in. So you take a little blue pill and nothing happens for an hour, and then, provided you have the right circumstance, you might get an erection. Now, men complaining bitterly of working on her and getting her in the mood and seducing her and cooking the dinner, and then he pops a little blue pill and an hour later she's fast asleep. How do you know you're going to get lucky? I mean, men. So another man talking about using the injection treatment, which is even worse in a sense because you actually have to get up and go and do it to yourself. A couple of men always look pale when I talk about this. It's not so bad. If you ever get, it's just like a little mosquito bite, the men tell me. It's not. The thought of injecting your penis is something that makes a lot of brave men turn very pale, but it's apparently okay. But in this case, he went and used his injection treatment. He came back. She not only was she out of the bedroom, the bed was made. She was nowhere to be seen. So, very frustrating. And I thought the women's reactions were really interesting to all of this. Because many of the women are very ambivalent about the whole idea of what it's like of using these treatments, and are very unhappy about, you know, one woman said, it makes me feel used, the fact he's using something chemical, he's using something artificial. And I found that very interesting, really, because if it was a pacemaker, would she react like this? But there was considerable resistance from many of the women to this whole idea of men using these new erection treatments. Fascinating material, because I had these diaries, and so I could follow how it was working out from both points of view. One woman writing about the fact that, in her case, her husband, when he stopped getting erections, started to blame her and accuse her of various things. He said her vagina wasn't tight enough. I mean, this was, you know, she'd had her child 22 years ago. She didn't think that was actually really the explanation. And then she said he started complaining she wasn't stimulating him enough. I provided what stimulation I could manage each time until my wrists and hands felt strained and I felt I was developing RSI. I mean, some of it was terribly funny, but watching, you know, him blaming her, her trying to get her, and eventually they were able to talk about it. But there was real tension over this sort of issue. And difficulties in just the whole process of aging. I mean, even when men who aren't having problems with erections are going to need more stimulation as they get older. That, you know, women get used to the fact that when they're with a young man, everything just pops up without you even needing to touch it. Well, when you're with a 50-year-old man, you're probably going to have to give him some direct stimulation. And there are many of the partners who are just not used to having to do that and rather resented it. She handled it like she was dealing with a death adder, said one man. So, you know, this whole business of couples working together on some of these issues was really quite intriguing to follow. There's actually a very nice story about a couple who, which is all about her knowing quite exactly how to handle him. This is a couple who went shopping in a shopping centre. They arrive there in their car and the car breaks down. And she, he says, "Oh, well, you go do the shopping and I'll see what I can do." She goes and comes back with her shopping bags. And they're horrified because they have legs sticking out from under the car and a whole lot of people gathered around. And she realises he's only got shorts on and no underpants, and his private parts have suddenly become very public ones. So she's absolutely horrified, ducks down and tucks everything back in place, gets up, and there's her husband staring at her from the other side of the car. The NRMA mechanic had to have 3 stitches in his forehead. But, of course, sometimes it works the other way around, and there certainly are women who are older women, who are very women of every age, who are keen on having sex and who are very upset to find their partners are the ones who retreat. I have women talking about the fact that their husbands tried, one or other treatment once or twice and then just gave up and never came near her again. There are women who are really keen on maintaining their sexual lives. Here too, there are some hilarious stories. I always love these stories about older women. And my absolute favourite concerns a 80-year-old Jessie who goes into the common room of a man's retirement home. She waves her clenched fist in the air and announces, "Anyone who can guess what's in my hand can have sex with me tonight." An elderly gentleman in the rear shouts out, "An elephant?" Jessie thinks for a moment and says, "Close enough." Who invents these things? But, of course, it's true. I mean, I was talking to a woman the other day who runs a support group for the partners of women, partners of men who've had prostate cancer surgery. She says she's always got women in tears in her group who are so upset about the fact that their husbands aren't coming near them anymore. And even women who weren't very interested in sex, when all of a sudden he's just absolutely not interested and won't even talk about it, they realise how important it was to have that physical intimacy, and they really miss it. And here too, you may remember last year I was in terrible trouble for talking when I was talking about this whole desire issue, and I talked about the notion of just do it, and the fact that women, I was suggesting that women who have low desire need to think about the impact of rejection on their partners. And I explained this whole idea of just do it, which was about not about like women lying back and thinking of England and suffering through unwanted sex, but about just putting the canoe in the water and paddling and see what happens. And that many women we now know will experience arousal and orgasm even without desire. So it's an idea worth exploring. And here too I'm strongly arguing with these men that they have to just do it too. And think about the impact on their partners. And I had this lovely couple writing for me last year. He actually didn't have prostate cancer. He'd had heart surgery and was on medication as a result of that, and he wasn't getting erections. And she said, despite this, he really wanted to make love to her. "His affection and desire for me was truly beautiful and something I'll treasure always. It's hard to put in words what his gentleness, feather-like touches, kisses and cuddles did for me. It was a display of how deeply he loved and wanted to be with me and made me feel pretty special." And she talks at length about these lovely afternoons they'd spend together. But she then added a little note saying, I mean, she really missed that wonderful erection, that magnificent pinnacle of manhood, which is now like a shriveled up weed that's been given a dose of Roundup. So, but I mean, the point is, well, she makes the point well and truly that you don't need a penis to make love, and you can still give a woman pleasure with your hands, with your lips, whatever. And that's a very important message. I've included some wonderful material from men who make love to their partners without erections or with erection, capricious penises where the erection comes and goes. One man in particular who's an absolute delight with a very sexy partner who sometimes wants a second and third course, and he puts his You know, he's totally oblivious to whether you're an erection or not. He stuffs it in and either it gets erect or it doesn't. But it doesn't bother him. And his lovely, joyous attitude to that, I think, is a real lesson for men to stop panicking and to relax a bit more about this whole issue. Because there is also tragic evidence of the impacts it can have when a man does go into a blind panic. Last year I had this letter from a man who said, he contacted me after the sex diaries came out, and he said that he'd been in this really great marriage, very strong relationship, but they never had to talk about sex. I mean, they just did it. It all worked perfectly well, so there was no real reason to talk about it. And then he started to get problems with erections, and he said he just didn't know what to do. He was just panic-stricken. He stayed up later and later watching TV, never said a word to his wife. She didn't know what had happened. Why, you know, is he having an affair? What's going on? She got so upset, moved out into the spare bedroom. They're now divorced. And he read my book, which had a lot of, you know, some material on erections, and he wrote to me and he said he cried and cried. He realised he'd let this whole marriage slip away because he didn't know how to talk about this and he didn't know what to do about his erection problem. I mean, it's just craziness. But it's, of course, still a society we live in where we, you know, if we haven't learned to have open discussions about this issue, when something goes wrong, it then could create an enormous chasm in the relationship. As I said, we have these fantastic treatments now, and it's a real tragedy that not all men who can be helped are getting access to the treatments that would really work for them. I get hopping mad, you know, as you know, every time you turn to radio or television, there is this absolute rubbish nasal technology being advertised, where men are paying thousands and thousands of dollars for treatments that don't work. And it's all because men are too embarrassed to go and chat to their doctors about this. And often the doctors aren't terribly good, unfortunately, at having the sort of conversations they need to have about these issues with their patients. I was talking the other day to a group of urologists. Oh my God, if those men could have dug a hole in the ground to get away from me, they would have. I mean, they didn't want to know the sort of thing I was describing to them, which is their bread and butter. I mean, they fix these penises and do the surgery, and this is the other major function. So many men say to me after their prostate cancer surgery, after they know they're going to survive, the next thing they think about is sex and think about erections. And unfortunately, a lot of the doctors haven't had the training they need to be able to talk about these sorts of issues as well. The other big problem we have is the whole question of the costs of these treatments. And that's a very big issue. I find it the most extraordinary thing that we're in a situation where a breast is valued so much more than a penis. A woman who has a mastectomy, she's given, as she should, a certain amount of, you know, government funding for breast reconstruction, for prosthesis. We totally understand what a blow to her femininity it is to lose that important symbol, if you like, of her femininity. The men who have prostate cancer surgery are getting not a cent of government money towards the cost of their erectile dysfunction treatments. And I find that extraordinary. The other day I was talking to the National Press Club. We're launching a campaign, the Urology Society of Australia and New Zealand and the Prostate Cancer Foundation. We're all getting together trying to raise this issue. I know the reason that this issue never gets talked about, of course, is it's really hard for men to march in the streets for the right to an erect penis. But it's a reasonable cause, and I think we need to talk about it. And it just drives me crazy that whenever we talk about Viagra, you know, it's all a big giggle. It's a joke. We don't ever see it seriously. But it's a very serious issue for so many men, and it's a great shame that we don't allow them to talk more openly about that. And we need to get couples to be able to talk about this stuff, because that's the start of dealing with these sort of problems, for the couple to be able to open up about it. And I know that's not easy, it's really difficult. But I think one of the things that often helps a lot is, of course, to keep a sense of humour about it, so it doesn't get so deadly embarrassing and excruciating to discuss, and that's something I've always tried to do. Last year, I think when I was here, I mentioned that some of the funny stories I was getting from women, and one of the women who was talking about her whole desire issue had announced to her bookler that she'd said to her husband, "You can have 50 thrusts, but don't jiggle my book." Which was rather strange, really. There was an extract which mentioned that little story, extract of my book published in the Sydney Morning Herald. And on the Monday, a letter was published which went like this: "My wife is a very avid reader in bed. I don't know whether she found the novel so interesting or whether she wanted to be sure that by the time she put her book down, I was fast asleep. Once I told her, the girlfriends I had before her never read in bed. Yes, she answered, because they were illiterate. When she complained I was snoring, I told her this was my mating call, but she said this didn't work with her. When I told her I must be getting old because the girls don't even whistle anymore in the street when I pass, she reassured me, they still do, but your hearing is gone. I was very happily married for over 40 years, and I think a mutual sense of humour is the most important ingredient in a successful relationship. This is in memoriam. Thank you."
Thanks, Tina. Janet Grundy's got some copies of What Men Want in Bed. And so we come to question and discussion. We may have to finish a little bit early tonight because some of us have got to go home and write up our diaries, so it takes a while. And you need to take a neurosis pill to get it all out. So we come to question and discussion. Just before we get on, the last time you were here, I was fascinated by the two who... I don't know whether these people are still sending in their innermost thoughts to you, but the two who had an arrangement to have a go every 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning, just as Insider starts. Have you had any, had any feedback from them? And I've always been interested.
That's true. That is a problem. No, I haven't heard from them for a while. I'm keeping in touch with lots of my diarists, actually, and meeting them occasionally, which is rather nice. I really got to know a lot of them very well. They sent me photos of their children and their husbands and their dogs and their penises occasionally.
Dog's penises?
That too, no. So anyway, it was the most extraordinary experience. And a lot of them tell me that they miss writing for me, so, which is rather nice.
Extending that, firstly, how did you get all these people? What was the method? And when you keep this going, I mean, you could become their sextet.
No, well, I went on radio, I wrote bits and pieces for, newspapers and so on. They were all volunteers. I asked people, would they write for me? And it was easier, in a sense, this time, because I'd already done it the previous year. I still have people volunteering, and people write to me all the time wanting to do it. And I think, what was unexpected, talking about being their therapist, I didn't expect it to be therapeutic, but of course it is in a sense, and particularly when I did the research on the desire issues and I had so many couples writing for me, they really found that process of starting to write really helped them learn to talk to each other and learn to discuss things they never discussed before. And here too, even with the men, quite a lot of the men writing for me, actually, their partners don't even know they did that. So, women, you might want to have a good look at this book just in case he's in there. No. I very much tried to get both people involved, but it wasn't always possible. But it was interesting. That just the business of thinking about your feelings and writing them down, of course, helps you to understand yourself a bit better. Yeah.
Sorry, I missed you at the very beginning, but is there any... What's happening in terms of the pill for the woman? You speak about the men, the male options, but what's happening about the female options?
They're working on them very hard. The drug companies all over the world are trying to find... a solution to the problem of low desire, and you may have noticed Ray Moynihan recently wrote a book attacking this whole notion and essentially arguing that this is a problem manufactured by drug companies to make more money. It's just such rubbish. Every time the drug company looks for volunteers for a new drug to try to help with this problem, they just get knocked over in the rush. I was talking to a professor the other day who ran one of these trials in Adelaide last year, I think it was, and he said he had thousands of women from all over Australia volunteering. There are plenty of women who would love to pop a little pink pill. We haven't got there yet. The idea of a Viagra doesn't work, because they discovered that Viagra is all about increased blood flow in the genitals. A lot of women don't even notice that when that happens, which is interesting. Some do, and I was very interested to discover that the women who notice increased blood flow in the genitals tend to be the women who, because it tends to be around, measured in the vagina, and they're more likely the women who respond to vaginal orgasm, which is interesting. Anyway, so Viagra doesn't work. The best thing we've got at the moment is testosterone, which is available off, you know, has to be given off label, and that works for some women very well. And there was a new drug that recently came up before the drug evaluation people in America, and it was knocked back because it said it wasn't working well enough. I mean, obviously they look at averages, and with both these treatments, it's, some women it works quite well, and others it does nothing for. But they're now working really hard, not at drugs that will change things in the genitals, but I mean it's going to be between the head, between the ears rather than between the legs, the solution to this particular problem, because they're doing a lot of work on the whole brain mechanisms, and that's where I think there's no question they will come up with something, but they haven't got there yet.
Question here.
What I like about your writing books, etc., studying sex, is the fact that when I grew up, you know, 50, 60 years ago, we had no information available. And us so-called youngsters at the time, we didn't really know what to do with girls or your own body. So how come you didn't study that? You seem to be concentrating on the older generation's problems. Am I correct?
Maybe that's because I'm an older generation. No, I mean, I've been talking in this... I mean, I spent the first 10 years of my career as a young woman talking a lot about issues affecting young people. And I suppose it's inevitable I'll be more interested... I'm more interested in what's happening in my generation, and that's what I'm choosing to write about now. But also, this is brand new. I mean, the erection stuff is only just happened. And it was something that always really worried me. I mean, back when I was a sex therapist in 1973, I had nothing to offer men who had problems with erections, and it was just tragic. We didn't even know what caused the erection, what the mechanism was, let alone how to fix it. And so the fact that they have these new treatments is something I find very exciting. And other people could do, you know, the job of talking to young people. I'd rather talk about, you know, I suppose, the issues affecting people of my sort of age.
But the younger generation hasn't got a physiological problem. They have a psychological or emotional problem. So the problems are really different, aren't they?
They are. But, I mean, I think young people are actually doing a lot better than we were. Lots of young people are much better educated about sex. The women's magazines have done a great job educating young women. The internet has done an enormously good job, I think, at educating you. I mean, we always talk about the internet as this ghastly, dangerous thing, but it's actually doing an enormously good job educating young women, men and women, about sex. There's great material there.
There's a question in the middle there. Yeah.
Did your research cover the experiences of gay and lesbian people?
No, I looked at that because I originally started recruiting gay men, and I just became very conscious of the different levels of complexity there. And I felt, I mean, actually with both research projects, that I couldn't possibly do them justice, and I didn't know whether it made sense to, you know, do a chapter on gay sexuality. I mean, is that tokenism? I think a lot of the... Oh, clearly, all the stuff I'm writing about, the erection stuff, applies to men, whether in heterosexual or homosexual relationships. But there's been quite a lot of good research on gay sex. I think there's actually a bit less on heterosexual sex, and that's what I decided to focus on.
Question there.
Just a comment on the onset of action of these, well, 5-PD inhibitors such as Viagra, etc. There will be soon available a lung delivery system via a nebulizer the size of a matchbox, which will actually achieve peak plasma levels in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So that will be something.
That'll be good. Look, I mean, I think we'll see, obviously see more and more refinement of these treatments and you know, improvements, because there are problems with and other ones that are available now, but it's a darn sight better than it was 30 years ago.
Question here.
I saw a tweet by Mayor Friedman who said that after your Good Weekend article that a lot of husbands got sexy time that night. I was wondering if you thought that might be true and if you're at peace with that.
At peace with that? I'm delighted with that. I think, well, it was particularly true with my first project, I suppose, on desire. I saw a woman who was in a tuck shop, and she said, and I'd gone on Late Line the night before talking about these issues, and she said every woman in that tuck shop had had sex the night before. So, interesting. I don't think a little bit of guilt doesn't hurt anybody, really. And I hope I have the same effect on men and teach them to just do it and stop ignoring their wives if that's what they're doing too. It was always an equal opportunity measure. It was never an attack on women. And my message of just do it.
There's a causal problem there, isn't there? I mean, they might have been fantasising about Tony Jones. I mean,
that's right. Well, that's what, so he thought. He was very pleased with that idea.
Right, so it's down the back. I'm sorry, just a bit hard to hear. Yeah?
Tony, you're a very entertaining speaker. Have you ever taken your story to a much bigger audience? You know, like in the entertainment centre or somewhere?
If you organise it, I'll do it. Yeah. No, I love speaking, and I'm so much better than sitting at a computer writing books. So that's what I'd like to do now. And I used to do a lot of speaking internationally. And so spread the word, guys. I'd love to.
There's always a sex party.
Yeah, that's true.
But you took the sex diaries to Ireland, didn't you? So.
Oh, I did take.
And that was after you spoke here, I think. So what happened over?
Oh, Ireland was it's very funny because there was a. Irish radio station was terribly taken with this Just Do It idea, so they got Dublin to Just Do It. And made this announcement, so they got all these emails in, and then they went on holiday, so they came back, and they rang me up saying, we're really excited. So there were 11 pregnancies. And I said, oh no, don't they, you know, worried about... Oh no, they're all delighted. There were people who've been trying to get pregnant for 5 years. Anyway, I thought that was very funny, really.
Yes.
Oh, hi, Bettina. I heard you speak the other day to Richard Feidler, and you briefly spoke about women and their perception of their body and how lacking in confidence they were in their body. I'd just like you to elaborate on that, please.
Yes. Well, that was one of the issues I was very interested to get the men and women to talk about, because I had my half my life men complaining that their wives and their partners won't let them look at them. I mean, this is a really big issue because men love looking at their partners, naked partners. I mean, it's part of the treat for them. And yet we're just hopeless. I mean, as you know, so many women are really self-conscious about their bodies. They hate what they see. They're embarrassed about the idea that he's looking at the cellulite or the floppy boobs or whatever it is. And they just cannot believe him when he says that's not what he's looking at. He just enjoys looking at what he sees as her beautiful body. And so I have wonderful material from men talking about that and talking about how much they would love to be able to see her and how sad it is that she's always clutching the sheets around her neck. And, you know. Of course, it's very hard to convince women of that. And I mean, actually women were quite funny. Some of them said they quite like to see a little bit less of their partners. And they just totally stunned. Did you see that? What was that Meryl Streep movie with... And here he is. What was it called? Meryl Streep is having an affair with her ex-husband. And
it's complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated. And he's got a bit of a paunch, and he's strutting around, proud as punch, and she's clutching sheets around her. And that really captured that issue. And how extraordinary it is that so many men are totally unself-conscious about the way they look. And as some of the women pointed out, it's not necessarily a pretty sight.
You write a lot of the couples that had issues with the level of desire between them, or people who wrote, you know, were unhappy about that. Did you have a sense that at the end of that process, of the diary process, how did things end up? Did you see a change, or was it just an acceptance of it?
It depends. I mean, it depended whether... If I got both of them participating, a lot of the time it did produce a real change. And I mean, it was just amazing to see, because you could just see the tension start to ease away. But, I mean, as I said, sometimes I only had one person and not the other participating. And there was one example where I had... the man had been just pouring his heart out about how unhappy he was about being constantly rejected. And weeks and weeks and weeks he'd been writing for me. And then totally out of the blue, and she refused to participate. And then totally out of the blue, I got this email saying, "I'm the ice princess he keeps writing about, and this is my story." And then she poured it all out. You know, and then it wasn't just them writing for me. I was sending the material and chatting to people and trying to help people. I mean, it wasn't just let them struggle. And so quite often, just learning a bit more about it. I mean, the whole desire issue is very much about the fact that people can't help this. This is not a nasty trick women pull on men. And it's not about, you know, the beat of a honey pot and then, you know, closing down. I mean, women, a lot of women really don't want to have low desire. They're really unhappy about it. And they're very conscious of the tensions it causes in the relationship and so on. So I think even that understanding can help people when they start to talk to each other a bit more about this. And I hope the same will be true of the whole erection issue. I think men make a very powerful case of why it's so important to them. And I hope women will listen to that and not dismiss it as, oh, for goodness sake, it's just sex, you know. Haven't you got over that? I've deserved a rest. I love that. Women writing sex, I've deserved a rest, you know. But, I mean, I know, you know, there's a whole feminist literature saying, why don't, you know, men understand they don't need their erect penises. I mean, it's not about need. It's about, you know, the men's sense of themselves as men. And who are we women to tell them, you know, how they should feel? So I think there's often real double standards in the way we talk about male sexuality, and the whole discussion tends to be conducted by women these days. Women tut-tutting on talk shows, saying, you know, you naughty males in trouble for, you know, chasing women or for looking at sexy photos or for whatever it is. And men never say boo, men never talk for themselves, and I'm delighted to have men talking for themselves. And I hope women will read about what they have to say.
Well, there's a question out the back.
You've mentioned only a lot of your interviews and diaries. Were they only with couples, or did you touch on this single? Because it seems to be the single society is getting bigger and bigger right through all ages.
Hmm. I mean, I had some singles, and particularly with the whole erection issue, I was very interested to see how the single men dealt with that. Very difficult. There's actually support groups for young men who've had prostate cancer. You can get prostate cancer in your 40s. And those guys really up against it, you know, to go out dating when you have these sorts of... that particular issue. But I also had, so I had a lot of men writing about that, talking about what that's like. I had some lovely examples of men who've dealt with it very well, you know, and talking about what it's like to be dating and when do you announce I might have this little problem, but, and finding that a lot of women are very understanding in that situation. So I think that I hope will give a good example to people that you can deal with these issues, particularly if you're willing to talk about it.
Okay, so we're getting close to the end. Up the back, yeah.
Then how do these issues translate across borders? You talked about Ireland, but what about the United States, England, some of the Asian countries?
Yeah, look, I mean, mine is very much, you know, just a little example from our culture. And it's not, you know, of course, they all tend to be more educated people, people who are willing to write about these things. So it wasn't meant to be... all-embracing, and it's certainly not a good cross-cultural analysis at all. But I was very intrigued. I mean, the Sex Diaries has been translated into an extraordinary range of... I mean, the option for publishing it has been taken up by Israel. It's being translated into Hebrew as we speak. Spain, Argentina, Finland. I mean, most extraordinary mixture of countries. So, I don't know. Presumably it means that it touched a chord in those countries too. I don't know how this one will go. But the erectile dysfunction thing, of course, is a plot. Everyone across the world is struggling with that and dealing with the new treatments. So one hopes that this might be of value to people everywhere.
So as a final question, after the sex diaries and what men want in bed, what's next?
Well, no more books, I hope. No, I mean, I do actually want to do mainly speaking from now on if I can. In particular, I'm very keen to get back into a bit more education of doctors. I spent my life, early career, one of the things I did was teaching medical students, and I'm hoping to do a lot more of that now. It just really worries me that I actually have a daughter who's a medical student, and they're getting very little good education on sex as part of their medical training still. And yet it's, I think, a bigger and bigger part, particularly of a general practice, particularly for urologists and another, other specialties. And so that's one of the areas I really want to work in now and just go out and talk to people. I love going out and talking to community groups about these sorts of issues. It's a fascinating process and much more fun than sitting writing books. Thanks very much.
So it's great to have Bettina Arndt back at the Sydney Institute. There may not be any more books in this genre, but I'm sure there'll be something else, and I'm sure you'll be back in the not-too-distant future. As I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of Bettina Arndt's most recent book, and for tonight, well done for a speech. Was informative, but as always, entertaining. Well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.